bin Salman, the crown prince of the Saudi regime, ousted his nearest rivals in a bloodless coup that essentially made him the de facto ruler of the kingdom, going as far as imprisoning some of his relatives and even killing people who spoke out against him, none more so infamous than the brutal fashion in which the journalist Jamal Khashoggi met his fate at the hands of bin Salman's murder hit squad. Part of the regime that bin Salman wished to implement under his rule was the so-called 2030 vision, a plan that would see the kingdom introduce a strategic framework designed to reduce the nation's dependence on oil and concentrate on other sources of income. Many question whether this will be a success, with certain examples already proving to be a failure, with various sporting personalities refusing to attend high-profile events in the country. However, some have agreed, and some academics feel that the move away from oil onto more diverse projects has potential to succeed.
I think that the new approach, which is reflected in the broader 2030 vision, if implemented as outlined, it will take off. Now, that is contingent on the government and the leaders implementing, creating the environment which is very key for you to take off. This will include, of course, some of the things that are already outlined in the vision. In particular, a continuation would be development of infrastructure.
But for bin Salman and his grand idea, there still lies several fundamental flaws in his approach. Firstly, as we've discussed, is the shocking history of human rights in the country, as seen in the murder of Khashoggi, but also the inequality between men and women, the notion of modern slavery in the kingdom, the terrible ongoing destruction of Yemen, and of course, the infighting between Saudi royals themselves, all lead many to question as to just how far this project can go before it collapses. The idea, however, is something that other nations in the Persian Gulf region have also considered adopting, with the likes of the United Arab Emirates, for example, branching out into fields of tourism and technology, and the Persian Gulf state of Qatar, which is also thriving outside of its gas income, with the FIFA World Cup heading to Qatar next year, and of course the highly successful aviation industry, spearheaded by award-winning Qatar Airways, notably the only operator to thrive during the COVID-19 pandemic.
If you look at the Gulf countries, they both seem to have taken quite a similar pattern. They all seem to have developed a broader economic and political and social kind of framework, which the end. I think the difference is that the pace of development is quite maybe slightly different, or the pace of the implementation is quite slightly different.
Joining us back in the studio is Hossein Askari. Professor, Saudi Arabia and other Persian Gulf states have taken huge steps to move away from economic reliance on oil, coming up with a range of alternative economic plans. Do you think that this tactic will work, or will setup costs prove too costly?
Well, I think that eventually, of course, oil runs out. And so any country has got to do something to make sure that this oil lasts in some fashion. Now, I am a firm believer in Islamic economics and what the Quran teaches about finance and economics. And it's very, very clear, no one with any brain can dispute this, that in Islam, what is under the ground, namely depletable resources, belong equally to all members of the present and future generations. But let me just say this, to be able to transform your economy from oil to something else, you need more than just a vision. You need more than just somebody saying, we're gonna do this. You need to create a setup in a country where there is the rule of law and where there are incentives for the private sector to develop those things. Saudi Arabia has not done that. And so when you try to, as a government, to try to set the direction for how you're going to go from an oil economy to a non-oil economy, it's very difficult for the government to say, well, we're going to pick this particular sector, that particular sector, and invariably it doesn't work. And until you have a setup, an environment, the condition for the private sector to flourish, and Saudi Arabia does not have that. So I think it'll be a very costly mistake in the long run, because it has not done the spade work in order to set up for a resurgence of the private sector.
Okay, not too optimistic there for Saudi Arabia. Atifa bin Salman has stated that he wants to diversify the Saudi economy, said that many times. And of course, he's talked about this 2030 vision that Professor there also talked about, the aim to boost tourism, infrastructure, leisure, recreation, things of that nature. But there have already been several boycotts of Mohammed bin Salman, really, in particular, and Saudi Arabia as a whole, by the idea about these big brand names who and stars who want to actually make advancements, but they're concerned about the human rights record of Saudi Arabia. Do you think that this plan, this vision is going to work? Or do you think that Saudi Arabia actually has too many skeletons in its closet?
Well, Mohammed bin Salman established his authority through massive crackdowns on the dissent, locking up competitors in luxury hotels, ordering the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, waging a war in Yemen, and being involved in a blockade on Qatar. Now, these sort of behaviors discourage many investors, and a lot of investors in the future are thinking, is this a man that we want to work, a pro-violence, anti-democracy guy? They're looking for safe places to invest, especially with the ongoing pandemic and the financial crisis across the globe. So I don't think that the investors are going to be encouraged to invest in this vision. And at the same time, Bin Salman was heavily reliant on the income from oil to make this dream happen. And with the drop in the oil revenues and the ongoing pandemic, I think his dream is dying away.
Okay, very well. Well, we're about to take a quick break here on Economic Divide, but don't go anywhere, as we have plenty more coming up, including more from Atifa and a new section of our show. It's called A Thousand Words. So don't go away. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Economic Divide with me, Kavita Hawaii. Time now to take a look at a change of policy in Arab-Persian Gulf states in our in-depth section. Now, as we have seen in recent months, several nations have normalized ties with the Israel regime, including the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco. Many suggest that the Saudi regime may also follow the trend, but Riyadh appears to be stalling for now. Well, according to a report by Karen Uziel of Focus Economics, which was cited in this entry, she has stated that the biggest winner of the normalization of ties with the Israeli regime will be the poorest nation, that being Sudan. Yet between Israel, the UAE, and the U.S., a $3 billion fund promoting economic developments will be launched, which may also tempt the Saudis. Now, she also has stated that for Saudi Arabia to fully and officially normalize ties with Israel will mean a change of power at the top, believing that Bin Salman will have to replace his father for that to happen, which may spark huge protests and then in the process let down the people of Palestine. Well, the Israeli regime has offered to sweeten the deal with the Saudis by offering them an incentive, namely providing the so-called Iron Dome missile system once ties are normalized, something that the Saudi regime will no doubt at due time, due to his love of weapons, may jump at this. But for now, it has rejected it. Well, Israel itself is desperate for business. For example, check out this entry over here, an Israeli-Saudi Silicon Wadi to benefit both. Now, this is for the tech sector. An Israeli-Saudi union here will obviously benefit both, but Israel is looking to expand itself because of the fact that COVID-19 has affected countries around the world, and one of the main sources of income for the Saudis was the U.S. Cybersecurity, for example, is one of the fields, not to mention agritech, fintech, and digital health.
They say the difference between a man and a boy is the price of his toys. And this is no different for Bin Salman, who since taking pseudo charge of the country has spent billions on military hardware, ranging from the latest fighter jets to the most devastating bombs, most of which come from Western suppliers, and in particular, the United States of America. But the military deals taking place are riddled with corruption, hence proving why so much spending has left the kingdom with such a huge deficit, all caused by the bad deals that allow certain individuals to profit in the process.
there have been, in fact, some military contracts in which the commission was larger than the actual contract, maybe over 100%. There have been military contracts in which later on what are called the add-ons were larger than the initial contract, which also tells you that there was corruption going on, so they had to basically later on come and add money to it to make up for it. Namely, the contractor was told what was the highest other bid so that or the lowest other bid, I'm sorry, so they could go below that. So there are all of these things why the military contracts occur.
However, for the cameras, the corruption is not an issue, as the likes of Trump and Bin Salman laugh and joke about billion-dollar contracts, which Trump labelled as peanuts to the Saudi regime. The final destination of the weapons and bombs bought from the US and the UK is no laughing matter. Bin Salman's also been the mastermind and chief instigator of the ongoing war in Yemen, where the very deal signed by the Saudis to buy US weapons has seen over 233,000 people killed in the country at the hands of Saudi attacks and sanctions. With the war looking like an unwinnable mission for Riyadh, it seems that the excessive spending on military hardware, some of which has never been used, either through lack of knowledge as to how to use it, or simply not having had the opportunity to do so, has meant that the overall budget on the war has brought few tangible gains for the Saudi military, with estimates placing the Saudi spending on the war in Yemen being at around $200 million per day. It's no wonder then that the Saudi budget has run down.
We're joined back in the studio with Atafe, but before we head into our discussion, let's hear one more time from Professor Hossein Askari. We asked him a question about the Saudi military program.
The military expenditures, it's done for a variety of reasons. Let's just be very frank about it. Saudi Arabia cannot really defend itself, but it does not have anyone who wants to invade it. And if anyone does invade it, Saudi Arabia will get the backing of the United States military, and now I believe of Israel's. So why do they spend all this money on military? Well, I think it's number one is to reward the U.S. military complex, because the United States wants to export military hardware that reduces the cost of every unit that the U.S. military then buys. There's a second reason, and that is corruption. Is that in fact the commissions that are paid in military contracts are enormous. They run into the billions. So it's a way to channel money to various people inside and outside Saudi Arabia. I believe that much of that equipment is not against foreigners, but is to be used eventually if there is a domestic disturbance. And so it is pre-positioned for Americans to come and help the Saudi family out.
He was a great guest for this program. Okay, Atafe, we have seen Donald Trump accepting billions of dollars from the Saudi regime, obviously in return for what the professor said there, for military weapons. This week actually saw another $290 million of arms being sold to Saudi Arabia, well, approved to be sold to Saudi Arabia. And this is a last push by Trump to arm, obviously, his friend, especially Mohammed bin Salman. Now, do you think that the incoming President Joe Biden, if he does actually get confirmed, is he going to be following Trump's footsteps, do you think?
Well, Saudi Arabia has been the United States' greatest ally in this region. I don't think that alignment is going to change with Biden coming to the office. But I think Biden is a man who cares about his international image, so he would be more careful the way he treats Saudi Arabia. But in terms of economic trades, I think there are going to be more trade deals between these two countries, especially now that the United States is in financial trouble itself. But in other things, I think regarding the human rights issues, Biden would be more careful to address these issues, things that, for example, Bin Salman does, you know, the thing that he does. I think that's the only thing that would change. That's it.
Very well. Thank you very much for your input. We appreciate it. Atafe Payadar, researcher and journalist. Sure. The Saudi regime is run by a family that appears to be living a lavish lifestyle, fueled by oil sales that provide easy income to spend on luxury goods, sophisticated military weapons, and most worryingly of all, buying the silence of the Western international community following the brutal assassination of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. But it seems that the impact of the coronavirus and the slump in oil prices have left the bank vaults of the Saudi regime with bare shelves, raising the question as to whether the kingdom is being mismanaged by a young, inexperienced, and power-hungry crown prince who has yet to understand the value of money. What now remains to be seen is whether oil prices will increase in the near future, and if so, what lies ahead for the Saudi regime, with outgoing President Trump causing Riyadh to lose yet another ally, and hence the possible reason why it is now extending the hand of friendship to Tel Aviv, something that many will no doubt condemn as an act of treason. That's just about all the time we have for this episode. I'd like to thank both Professor Hossein Askari and Professor Collins Nithman for being on the show. And on behalf of myself, Atifa, and the whole team here on Economic Divide, stay safe.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked.
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example.
Self purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism. This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech from IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Sayyid Mohsen Kharrazi. Please stay tuned.
آیه دیگه هم در اینجا عرض میکنیم با اون آیه مبارکه اینه که فرماید اعوذ بالله من الشیطان.
In آیه 152 of سوره البقره we read, remember me and I will remember you, and thank me and do not be ungrateful to me. In this verse of the Holy Quran, remembrance of Allah means that we, in every aspect of our lives, pay attention to Allah and His signs in our lives. It also means to be attentive to things which help us to remember Allah, such as the Holy Quran and the infallible Imams. In better words, everything which can be considered a means to connect us to Allah must be taken care of. The answer to our remembrance of Allah is He remembering us, and this is great reward for Muslims. Now, how Allah will remember His servants. Some scholars believe that Allah will send His special blessings upon the servants who remember him frequently. Thus, know that whenever someone remembers Allah in every action in life, in answer, Allah will remember that person too. And Allah is grateful to those who are thankful towards him. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Khalaf Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Sayyid Mohsen Kharrazi. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en Khalaf Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Huddled in a command center on Wednesday afternoon, 6th of January, Mayor Muriel Bowser of Washington and her aides saw a photograph of bloodstains on the temporary grandstands at the Capitol, a makeshift structure built for the inauguration of a new president in 2 weeks' time. The enormity of the deadly failure then sank in. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Mark Mazzetti, Helen Cooper, Jennifer Steinhauer, Zolan Cano-Young and Luke Broadwater. The piece is titled Inside a Deadly Siege, How a String of Failures Led to a Dark Day at the Capitol. Stay with us for more. Huddled in a command center on Wednesday afternoon, 6th of January, Mayor Muriel Bowser of Washington and her aides saw a photograph of bloodstains on the temporary grandstands at the Capitol, a makeshift structure built for the inauguration of a new president in 2 weeks' time. It was then that the enormity of the deadly failure sank in. Rioters had broken through the thin police line on the Capitol steps and were descending on hundreds of lawmakers conducting the ceremonial quadrennial act of certifying the presidential vote, and the mayor and her aides were not able to stop the attack. Muriel Bowser and her police chief called the Pentagon asking for additional D.C. National Guard troops to be mobilized to support what officials were realizing was inadequate protection at the Capitol, but they were told that the request would first have to come from the Capitol Police. In a call to Chief Stephen Sund of the Capitol Police, they learned that his force was under siege, lawmakers were being rushed to safety, and rioters were overrunning anyone in authority. He kept repeating the same phrase, "The situation is dire." Cutting through the crosstalk, one person on the call posed a blunt question. "Chief Sund, are you requesting National Guard troops on the grounds of the Capitol?" There was a pause. "Yes," Chief Sund replied, "I am." Yet the Capitol Police and the city's Metropolitan Police had rebuffed offers days before for more help from the National Guard beyond the relatively modest contingent to provide traffic control, so no additional troops had been placed on standby. It took just over 4 hours for them to arrive. It was just one failure in a dizzying list that day, and during the weeks leading up to it, that resulted in the first occupation of the United States Capitol since British troops set the building ablaze during the War of 1812. But the death and destruction this time was caused by Americans, rallying behind the inflammatory language of an American president who refused to accept the will of more than 81 million other Americans who had voted him out of office. President Donald Trump's call at a rally that day for the crowd to march on the nearby Capitol building was surely a spark that helped ignite the deadly riots that left 5 people dead, including a policeman and a woman who stormed the building, injured dozens of others, and damaged the country's reputation for carrying out peaceful transfers of power. But the tinder for the blaze had been gathering for months, with every tweet that the election had been stolen, every refusal by Republican lawmakers to recognize Joseph Biden as the next president, every dog whistle call that emboldened white supremacist groups to violently strike. A full reckoning will take months or even years, and many lawmakers have called for a formal commission to investigate the events of that day. But an initial anatomy of the siege by the New York Times revealed numerous failures. The chaos showed that government agencies have no coordinated plan to defend against an attack on the Capitol building, especially one specifically aimed at powerful elected officials. Though law enforcement agencies have for years raised alarms about the growing threat of domestic terrorism. QAnon, an online conspiracy group that was well represented among the crowd, has been labeled as a domestic terrorist threat by the FBI. Federal agencies and the Capitol Police appeared to issue no serious warnings in the days leading up to the riots that the gathering could turn violent, despite countless posts on right-wing social media sites pledging confrontation and even bloodshed. The Department of Homeland Security invited local law enforcement agencies to its Situation Room, held online during the pandemic, only the day before the riots, which some security experts said was far too late. Poor planning and communication among a constellation of federal, state and local law enforcement agencies hamstrung the response to the rioting on 6th of January. Once the Capitol building was breached, a patchwork group of reinforcements was forced to try to navigate a labyrinthine complex of unfamiliar passages and byways that would prove dangerous. Above all, the fiasco demonstrated that government agencies were not prepared for a threat that, until recently, seemed unimaginable. When the person inciting the violence is actually the President of the United States. The Capitol Police and the Metropolitan Police Department did not respond to requests for comment. Muriel Bowser's Chief of Staff, John Falsicchio, said that defense officials determined the number of personnel deployed, but Pentagon officials said they made those decisions based on specific requests that they received. The recriminations began almost immediately, and the violence also carried a sobering reality. The country got lucky. Hundreds of rioters carrying weapons breached the seat of American government, some with the clear intent of injuring, holding hostage, or even killing federal officials to stop them from certifying the vote. In the end, all of the lawmakers were spirited away to safety. It was such an embarrassingly bad failure and immediately became an infamous moment in American history, according to R.P. Eddy, a former American counterterrorism official and diplomat who now runs a private intelligence firm. R.P. Eddy added, "But it could have been so much worse. The Capitol is our goal. Everything else is a distraction," announced one post on far-right social media just a day before the uprising. "Every corrupt member of Congress locked in one room and surrounded by real Americans is an opportunity that will never present itself again." That was just one example of how extremists were organizing on social media. In private Facebook groups, activists planning to make the trip to the Capitol discussed not only logistics like hotels and ride shares, but also sleeping in cars and pitching tents should they need to occupy the city. Many comments included photographs of guns and ammunition that they planned to bring to Washington. On smaller social media platforms such as Parler and Gab that became rallying places for the far right, calls for violence were more overt. Dozens of posts in the days leading up to Wednesday, 6th of January, listed assault rifles and other weapons that people claimed they were bringing to Washington. People discussed which types of ammunition were best and whether medics would be in place for those potentially injured. Law enforcement officers and other officials were aware of the chatter and took some steps to try to reduce the chances of violence. The Department of Homeland Security officials put tactical agents on standby in downtown Washington. The FBI questioned neo-Nazis who were under investigation and planning to attend the demonstrations, prompting some of them to change their plans and skip the trip, according to officials. And on Monday, the Metropolitan Police Department arrested Enrique Tarrio, the leader of the Proud Boys, a far-right extremist group. The police also announced before the rally that anyone who planned to show up to the demonstrations armed in violation of local firearms laws would be arrested. But missed opportunities abounded on that day. Despite the ominous social media posts, officials leading intelligence-sharing centers throughout the United States received no warnings from the federal government about the potential threat to the Capitol building. "We did not see any federal products related to this," said Mike Senna, the president of the National Fusion Center Association. Such centers were formed after the 11th of September 2001 attacks to improve communication and planning among federal and local agencies. One senior federal prosecutor in the Midwest said he did not even speak with a top FBI agent in his city about local residents possibly traveling to Washington on 6th of January. What the FBI has been observing online, officials would later say, amounted to First Amendment protected activity, despite the incendiary language in social media posts. Meanwhile, intelligence experts have denounced the inability or refusal of government analysts to provide proper warning about impending violence. The evidence is starkly clear that the momentum of violence has shifted to the right in this country. We've seen this in city after city, said E.P. Eddy. There was a failure among law enforcement to imagine that people who look like me would do this. Chase Jennings, a spokesman for the Homeland Security Department, said in the days leading up to the breach at the Capitol building, the agency had opened channels with partners and shared information on those channels. Looming over preparation was the government's heavy-handed response to the Black Lives Matter demonstrations over the summer. President Donald Trump had deployed unidentified agents and tactical teams to the streets of Washington last June against the wishes of Mayor of Washington Muriel Bowser and agents tear gas protesters, allowing the president to walk to a nearby church and stage a photo opportunity holding a Bible. In the run-up to the violence on Wednesday, 6th of January, the fractured relationship between federal and local law enforcement agents was evident. Washington's Mayor Muriel Bowser had sent a letter to top federal law enforcement officials on Tuesday, warning against excessive deployment. Though the city had sought some National Guard troops for traffic control, she noted that the Washington, D.C. police had not requested additional personnel from law enforcement agencies for the rallies on Wednesday, 6th of January, and referred to the aggressive deployment last June. Still, federal law enforcement officials conveyed to lawmakers that they were prepared. David Bowditch, the FBI deputy director, assured Senator Mark Warner of Virginia, the top Democrat in the Senate Intelligence Committee, that the FBI had the resources to handle the Trump rally on Wednesday, 6th of January.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
By the first verse of the Holy Quran,
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Allah will bless you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Protect you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Help you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
So ask His blessings.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His protection.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His help.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaikum. Dear listeners, you're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Youth Station Choo Choo Kachoo. It's the Youth Station for you. I'm your host, Muzaffar Haider. Here in the studio today, we have with us
Mehdi Najafi.
Mehdi Najafi. That's right. You're not from Najaf, though, are you?
Well, I've been there, yeah.
You've been there?
Yeah, I've been there.
Well, there's a word in Arabic, and I can't find the English equivalent for it. I've tried really hard, and it's very difficult. as is the case with so many Arabic words.
Yeah.
So the word is haya.
Al-haya.
Yeah.
As you said, you haven't been able to find a word in English that translates inaccurate. Yeah. You won't.
Yeah. You're not going to. But, I mean, can we try?
Yeah, yeah, sure. But, like, you won't find a single word. You know why? Because haya, even in Arabic, does not have a single meaning.
I just want to clarify. We're not talking about haya.
Haya. We're not talking about haya.
We're not talking about life. We're talking about what?
Yeah.
Shame?
Right. Almost, but no.
Yeah. Modesty?
Modesty, shame, remorse. I don't know. We'll see. We'll see.
Okay.
See, why we say that there's no... single, that there's not a single meaning, just one meaning for haya in English, is because in Arabic, in ahadith, we've got different things about haya. For example, haya with a hamza at the end. For example, al-haya'u yamna'u al-rizq.
Ahsant, right.
Right. It says, haya, what does it do? It stops sustenance. Right? It stops sustenance from reaching you. In that sense, if I take haya for something like that, it's probably like being shy in English.
Right.
Or, you know. Shy or... But the shy in a negative manner in English. Like the most negative thing in English you have when you say shy, that's the meaning of al-haya over here when I talk about like haya, yamna al risk, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, in this hadith, it's talking about being shy, or actually embarrassment, being embarrassed to be able to... For example, you worked, right?
I worked.
10 days.
Okay, 10 days.
Right?
10 days.
Hard work. Hard work,
I'm
right?
Sweaty.
Yeah, and you're still sweating from those 10 days, you understand what I'm saying? Yeah. So, that's hard work. You've still got the cramps. And the person
it's giving me nightmares.
Sorry?
It's giving me nightmares.
Nightmares, yeah. Well, you can't sleep.
I can't sleep.
You don't have nightmares, sleep. You know? Like, that's how you talk. How
when
tired
I try
you
and
are.
Sleep, I wake up in the middle of the night just thinking, work.
Oh work, you know?
It was so hard, yeah.
That actually happened to me, you know? I've been in the position that when I sleep, I see the same environment, and I'm awake, and I'm like, oh, thank God, I'm not there. Anyway, so what I'm saying is, so the person's not paying you up.
He's not paying me?
Yeah, he's not paying you, and now... You're a bit iffy and you hesitate and you're like, oh, I don't know, it's a bit awkward. Should I or should I not ask him a follow-up? Yeah, that despicableness, is that a word?
No.
That despicableness, yeah. That's the type of haya, that's the type of that feeling. Islam says that stops your sustenance, that yamna'u, like it stops it from there. Like yamna'u means like it is going to stop someone from doing something. Like,
but that's not haya.
That's what I was about to say. That haya in Arabic doesn't have one meaning. Even in Arabic, it doesn't have a meaning. So you have to look at what context there is. What context is?
Listen, before we start diving into the twilight zone of Arabic words, right?
Yeah.
Let's just try and define what it means generally speaking to general people. We're talking about shame, right? We're talking about modesty. We're talking about the idea that you want to clothe yourself.
See, now there. That's a different definition, right? That's what I was about to reach. See,
wow, but that's a stark difference in the translation, isn't it?
The same word, exact same word.
The daughter of Hazrat Yaqub, she walks modestly.
Hazrat Shu'aib.
She
over there, it says you can define it. It's completely all right to define it with modesty. Right?
Right.
But is it all right to say modesty stops sustenance? No. Whereas the same word has been used, is used in Arabic over here.
Okay, but more generally speaking, it is referring to that kind of modesty, right?
That kind of modesty, I'm not sure, because that is the modesty that a woman has or a man has, like between them, there's a certain modesty. But what about Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala?
Uh-huh.
Do you have the same modesty? No.
What do you mean?
Let me take support from this hadith that I have in front of me, right? It says al-haya ala wajhain. Haya is of two, it has two faces, or like
cool,
it's got
cool,
two,
okay.
Two is one is faminhu da'fun, one is weakness.
Uh-huh.
Wa minhu quwwatun wa islamun wa iman. And the other is strength, submission, and faith.
It reminds me of when Imam Ali alayhi salam was in the battlefield, and that mal'oon, he knows that Imam Ali is going to come and destroy him now, because he's cornered, right? So what does he do? He rips off his clothes, he strips naked. Now, a'udhu billah, he's standing there. Imam Ali alayhi salam, he turns his gaze away.
Wow. Looks away. Bro, you know the our other brothers, Sunni brothers, what they say when they take Imam Ali's name, they say, Ali karramallahu wajhu.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It means Allah has given grace to his face. Mm-hmm. Right? That's mm-hmm. what it means. And, you know, like, in Arabic, you know, but like, our listeners, certain phrases, that there's something that hasn't been said, but it's already said. It's in taqdeer, right? It's there, but okay. Like, when someone who listens to it, he knows.
Right.
They say, there are two things that are completely possible about karamallahu wajhu. They said, ani sujudi lis sanam. Like Allah has raised his face from doing sajda to idols, prostrating before idols, or anin nadari lil awra. The same thing that you were mentioning.
Uh-huh.
Like he has not, at that point he turned away.
Yeah.
Right? He did not gaze upon that.
So it's interesting.
Person.
I mean, did we have a level of that innocence and that haya when we were younger and now it's gone for some reason, or maybe you still have it?
That's a very personal question, isn't it?
It is. But I want to say this hadith now. It's a beautiful, beautiful hadith from Imam Ali alayhi salam, and he says, modesty prevents ugly actions.
That's the question that I had in my mind. Like, is it the same thing with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Look, when that type of modesty that Imam Ali alayhi salam had, right, in the battlefield, is it the same as the modesty that you have before Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala?
Okay, now, what do you mean by this? Because this is throwing me off. Like, why do you need to have modesty in front of Allah? He sees everything.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. See, but that, you still have to have haya, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like,
please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
This is what I was about to say. If you've got this, by you, I mean like everyone, because I've got a few American friends. When I say you, they're like, why do you always like address the person in front of you, like you could be the same person.
I'm
person.
I'm not American.
Yeah, but people might be listening, right?
Mm.
So when this concept is in your head, that, as you said, that Allah is always watching, you've got this shame, you've got this hesitation before doing anything that you do, like, or at least we are supposed to have that, right? That he's watching, right?
Yeah.
Am I supposed to do this or am I not supposed to do this? Right, should I do this or should I not do this? That is also haya. Now, this got nothing to do with those the previous kinds of haya that we mentioned, right? Mm-hmm. But the word is the same, right? Same as like the kind of shame that blocks. Oh, that was the word I was looking for. Blocks sustenance. The same, that haya is used over there.
Right.
Modesty, when it comes to daughters of Hashem, Shu'ayb alayhi salatu wasalam, approaching Hazrat Musa alayhi salam, the daughter, the same word is used over there.
Yeah.
The third point was when you mentioned the battlefield, the same word is there. Or that's modesty and that's haya, right?
Well, since you mentioned in front of Allah, I was thinking of salah, because, you know, it's highly recommended that you wear decent clothing when you pray. And also, it reminded me. Sorry?
No,
it reminded me of back in the days of Jahiliyyah, people used to do Hajj naked.
Oh, that actually makes sense. Oh, does not make sense, sorry.
Well, in the modern day we have these naturalists and they say, oh, we should be naked because we shouldn't wear animals and stuff, you know. But back
then, in the modern day, there's a sect in Hinduism that actually still does that.
Really?
The priests do not dress themselves.
That's nasty, man.
Yeah. Well, that is, you know, but that's their approach, that they believe that you're supposed to be the same. They've got a mind-blowing explanation. Well, mind-blowing in the sense that you can you be that anyway? They're like, oh, my clothes could actually, there could be a fly that could get stuck in my clothes and it could die. and that's harming nature around me, so I'm not going to wear clothes. It's going to hit my skin and walk off.
Yeah, but my eyes have to hit your skin too, don't they?
Yeah.
But anyway, they used to do Hajj while naked, so that was like defying the concept of having haya in front of God Almighty. But then I wanted to ask you about having haya in front of parents, you know, for the youth. And also, haya, this is a very important one, because I think we've talked about kind of more philosophical points.
Right, yeah. Go on.
No, just about girls and boys.
Look, all right, mm-hmm. Girls and boys, I think we've kind of discussed that, addressed mm-hmm. that when it comes to daughters of Hashem. All right, if we elaborate on that, it's like, look,
Hashem
alayhi salatu wasalam's daughter, she was brave,
exactly, right?
She was brave. She did not approach in the manner that you say, oh, she hesitated. No, she was not hesitating. She knew what she had to do, and she had that barrier. Look, I've got a job to do. My father has told me to call you. He's calling you, and that's what I'm doing right now. And there's nothing more or less than this. That's it, you know? So they set the boundary over there, but she's got that limit. That limit is called haya, right? But what about this? La haya afiddin.
That means when you're discussing the deen, right?
Yeah, exactly. When you talk, that came to my mind when you mentioned parents.
Because they don't talk about the birds and the bees as they ought to, and then the kids just end up learning that stuff from school, and it's a corrupted version of what they're supposed to learn.
Yeah, precisely.
Right?
Precisely.
Like, imagine if every kid, right? I mean, this is a very controversial subject, but, you know, when it comes to that education to do with, you know, the birds and the bees, to do with reproduction, imagine if every child's first experience of learning about that stuff came from their parents. It would be different. It would affect their psychology differently, right?
Completely.
But what's happening is they're learning it from school, and usually teachers, especially in the West, they have no principles when it comes to...
They actually do have principles, but the worst principles.
The worst possible principles, right? I mean, I mean...
When you said once you learn it from your parents, it's a completely different thing. That's the same case with everything, every single thing that you're going to learn, right? For example, if you learn it from your parents, right, you actually know how to carry yourself about in society, right? And how you react to something that comes to you of this similar manner. But when you do, you've got no clue, then, I don't know, again, it's cliche, but that's the door for shaitan over there.
Right?
You've got this, because you're changing, right? You've got this change in your mentality, in your physical change.
There you have it, folks. That's all we have time for, unfortunately. Inshallah, we'll see you next time. From myself and from Brother Mahdi, we bid you assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
My love, my life, my days, my nights, my wealth, my prayers are for you. Now I know how it's like to have your precious love in my life. I wish that everybody knew how amazing it feels to love you. I wish that everyone could see how your love has set me free and made me strong.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 49 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.